Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement.
Came from the bottom, ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slang. Now we locked up again. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states, working your forms. Black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars. But you'll never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? You never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up.
Might work, still a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the rodent's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, races go. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland security now, there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Troops still riding, still obliging. Still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres. Take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early. Is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Forced to climb instead of how your back have you beat and lost your mind, especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got porn shop, gun shop, liquor store sign, SWAT team, crack fiend, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. This phone call cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent. Brothers not only dealing with the same drug selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same drug heritage.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America,
you know the black freedom movement constitutes your moral conscience. You know we've been trying to redeem the soul of the nation, even as that nation been trying to render us soulless. So we're our soulful people, the blues people. We've been keeping alive the bus, same banner of democracy. Thank God for those who came before. We shall never forget them and always move forward with grace and dignity.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America,
program tonight, talking about young people. I'm Dr. Tate. That song you just heard was by Dr. Cornell West, produced back in 2007 on Hidden Beach Records. The first rapper was I-Riz, my youngest son, followed by Raw Digga, Black Thought, and of course, Dr. Cornell West. The music was produced by my oldest son, Corey Cote Tatum. You are now tuned into the live podcast of Dr. Mary Lee Live. Tonight, we're going to be talking with young people.
I'm going to turn it over to Michael Hines. Mr. Hines, are you with us tonight?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. This ball is in your court, sir.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Dr. Tatum. Hello, and welcome to all of our listeners tuned in to this installment of Dr. Mary Lee Live. And welcome back to any returning listeners. My name is Michael, as Dr. Tatum said. I am a fellow co-host of the show, along with Dr. Tatum, as well as a community advocate for Black self-sufficiency and political literacy in the Black community. Now, on tonight's show, we'll be discussing the topic of unity between the Black male and Black female. And we'll be speaking with some special guests, Ms. Taylor Longs, a Black student advocate out of Howard University, Ms. Kaeja Kirkland, a Black youth coach out of Southwest Michigan College, Ms. Marilyn Ross Golden, a retired teacher and proud graduate of an HBCU with 33 years of experience educating Black children, and last but not least, Mr. Michael Kirby, a young leader out of Benton Harbor High School and captain of the Benton Harbor High School football team. But before we get into the show, I'm just going to go over our guest list again and allot some time for each one of our special guests to introduce themselves and tell us a little bit more about themselves, who they are, where they're coming from, and why they're here, starting with Ms. Marilyn Ross Golden. Ms. Marilyn Ross Golden, are you there? Ms. Marilyn Ross Golden, are you there? Can you hear me okay? Do we have Ms. Golden? All righty. Well, if we don't have Ms. Golden, do we have Ms. Taylor Longs?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay.
Would you just take as long as you need to, you know, introduce yourself, tell us, tell the listening audience who you are, where you're coming to us from, and why you're on the show tonight.
Sure. Thank you, Michael. Hello, everyone. My name is Taylor Longs. I am a current Howard University student. I'm 24 years old, coming from Detroit, Michigan. I went to school in Bloomfield Hills growing up. My father is the person who introduced me to this series. Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Mary Lee, and all of the guests that are here tonight. My father is Dr. Curtis Longs. He's a psychiatrist in the Detroit metro area, serving a lot of the youth and the area as well in Detroit. And he's someone who really inspired me to get more active in conversations like this and to involve myself more in the community. It's something that I've always been exposed to growing up, but I think with the duality of going to predominantly white schools growing up in Bloomfield Hills and then now venturing into my college career at Howard University, it's something that definitely made me realize that the conversation could be expanded more, and I'm just very grateful to be here. So thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Ms. Kaeja Kirkland, are you on the line? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. All righty. Thank you. Again, a little, as much time as you need, if you could just introduce yourself, tell us who you are, where you're coming to us from, and why you're on the show tonight.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaeja Kirkland. I am currently a student at Southwestern Michigan College in Dowagiac. I was invited to the show by Dr. Mary Lee, who was introduced to me by Dr. Pines, which I would really like to thank you because I really do appreciate it because I like everything. I am a youth coach. I have worked with a lot of youth throughout my lifetime right now, and I also have been in a lot of youth programs growing up too. So I'm just basically here to provide my perspective on things and learn things and take things from it as well.
All righty. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Do we have Mr. Michael Kirby on the line? Mr. Kirby, are you on the line?
Disconnected. Ready to pair.
All righty. Do we have Ms. Marilyn Ross Golden on the line now? Okay. Well, if any of those individuals come on the line later, we'll try to integrate them into the show. But As for right now, we'll move along. Before we get into the show, though, I do want to allow some time for any of the other co-hosts on the panel to give their introductions. Do we have Dr. Cannon on the line? Dr. Cannon, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead and introduce yourself and, you know, do what you do. Dr. Cannon, go ahead.
Beautiful, y'all. This is going to be an outstanding conversation, very timely. And, you know, even with, I think, Dr. Lee maybe showing up a little later and engaging the conversation. But when we talk about what's going on with, you know, young men and young women across this country, when we talk about the roles of young men and young women, you know, it's a powerful thing when you can go into life and you got a plan, a blueprint. Somebody's explained some things to you. You know, it helps you navigate around the pitfalls in life, the traps that's out there, when you can stay focused on your plan. You know, and a lot of times our young ladies, young girls go into life with no plan. And for many different reasons, because of disconnects, because of family, you know, a lot of times our young men go into life with no plan, no understanding. And as a result, we make decisions, sometimes life decisions, life-altering decisions, you know, because we have no plan and we get off focus. And then we get into fights and skirmishes unnecessarily, you know, but I think when we have a plan, you know, we don't have to fight each other. There's a scripture in the Bible that says if we fight and bite and devour one another, then we will be consumed of one another. And, you know, I see that with a lot of young people, you know, Afro-American young men, Afro-American young women, you know, young women saying bad things about Afro-American men, black men, and black men saying bad things about black women. I asked my aunt, Miss Katie Cannon, who was a renowned scholar, and I think I might have put the interview I did with her up on Facebook. She taught at Harvard Black Studies from a Female Standpoint at Harvard University. She's since passed away, Dr. Katie Cannon, powerful Afro-American woman, powerful really in her own right. She has several books out there. She was ordained into the Presbyterian Church as the first Afro-American woman ordained into the Presbyterian Church as a minister. I love her tremendously. But I asked her one day in an interview, I said, what is it men need to understand about black women? And what she said to me was that we're not the enemy. She said, we've always been for black men, all the way back through slavery. We are not the enemy. And we had a healthy discussion around that subject. So tonight, you know, to have a healthy conversation about some of the stereotypical things that's said about us that's true, and some of the things that's got us fighting one another that's not true, I guess the main question is, can we get along? Or how do we get along? How do we proceed as a strong people? And when people look at us, they say that's a people that's learned to get along and work together. We've got a lot of problems, yes, but I guess we're looking for solutions. And Mike, Dr. Tatum, Dr. Lee, beautiful conversation. I hope as we go into it today, I'll sit back and listen. Michael, I appreciate you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you for that.
I appreciate the guests that's come on as well tonight. We appreciate your everything that you bring tonight as well. I've worked with young people all across the country with my son, Nick Cannon, and I've worked with nonprofits and young people. And we, through his foundation, we motivate youth through the media. And this is a part of that, giving shows to people that have a voice and want to amplify their voice all across the nation, and we extend that opportunity. And so I appreciate you again, Mike, Dr. Lee, Dr. Tatum. Let's get into the conversation tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Dr. Cannon. And before I get to the first question of tonight's discussion, let me just remind anyone who may have joined us previously and may have forgot, or someone who's joining us for the first time, that if you want to get in on the conversation and you're in the listening audience, all you have to do is tap 1 on your phone, and then that will load you up into a queue. And when we allot some time for people in the listening audience to speak their piece, you'll be able to actually speak on the show and communicate with us and the panel. So just tap 1 if you're in the listening audience, tap 1 on your phone if you want to contribute to the conversation. Alrighty, first question of tonight's discussion, and it is directed at Miss Taylor Longs, and I'll give some time to the other panelists so that they can answer this question as well. Do you believe there is a noticeable conflict, or that there is noticeable conflict in the relationships between black males and black females in America, generally speaking? And if so, why do you think that is, from your own personal perspective?
Okay, so I would definitely agree that there are a lot of, I want to use a lighter term because I'm going to speak from my own personal perspective. So I believe there's a lot of grievances between black males and black females in the community. And when you ask the question of where that stems from, I think that it goes back to the environments that we come up in. Personally, growing up around predominantly white spaces, I noticed that there was pandering coming from both genders in terms of trying to pertain to the types of stereotypes that were either being presented or just making sure that you feel represented in a certain space. So I think that a lot of times we get misconstrued with our own insecurities, and then those project onto either me being a black female, maybe projecting onto the black male, and vice versa. So I think that it's definitely a prevalent issue, and there's so many different ways that it's presented, whether it be through colorism or any other topics that we'll definitely probably explore tonight. But as far as where it stems from, I definitely think that it's personal, but there's also a societal aspect that pertains to everyone that makes everyone project. Again, like I said, projection is, I think, one of the main things that leads to the feud between both black females and black males.
Okay, excellent. Would you say then, just to paraphrase, this validation seeking that you're proposing that black males and females are doing when they grow up in predominantly white environments, do you think this validation seeking makes them more at risk of, as you said, falling into stereotypes because they think that playing that role, so to speak, will gain them more favor and validation from their predominantly white peers?
Yes, definitely. And I think that I saw it a lot growing up, and I also see it manifesting, unfortunately, now in the spaces that I have, even at a historically black college. I think that when we live in a world that's centralized by white supremacy, then a lot of times, unfortunately, we fall victim to valuing ourselves underneath that spectrum. So I think that a lot of unlearning and a lot of healing is required for both ends, both black females and black males, to get to a better sense of self-love personally in order for us to love one another.
Would I be wrong, Mike? Just for clarity, is that validation? Would I be wrong if I called it a chip on the shoulder?
No. I think that,
or is
that
something different? Are you talking about something different? Are you saying that because we carry a chip on our shoulder when we go places, we may push that chip out, and that may be detrimental to what we're trying to progress, or am
yes.
I reading what you're saying different?
No, that's definitely, I think, where I was going with that point. I think that everyone's chip is different in size, and that kind of depends on the way that people act and how they really come about the way that they feel about themselves and how they treat other people within the community. I've seen it all throughout growing up, just in the way that both sides treat each other. It's not necessarily, I don't want to say it's more hate from one side, because there's so many different ways that it's been a part of my life that I can't just say that, oh, the hatred is coming from black males 100%, because there's a lot of stereotypes that both sides play into. So I think that it's something that we have to come together and have conversations like this to kind of get to the root of the issue, like you said, and the kind of the root of the chip on the shoulders of all of us.
Absolutely. And let me ask you another question. And I'm just going off of what, you know, a lot of other people have put out there, made some general statements about. Do you feel as if this validation seeking is, I know as a lot of other black people have suggested, due to a kind of implicit code, a social code, if you will, for increasing one's status within the context of, as you said, you know, the white supremacist, white privileged system we live in, do you think that validation seeking goes hand in hand with this idea that in order to ascend in social status in the context of America, given its history, you have to distance yourself from blackness and kind of make yourself more proximal to whiteness by trying to prove yourself, if you will, to the people you perceive as of a higher social status, let's say white people, if you're a black person, and that this can oftentimes manifest as, you know, degrading blackness, if you will, so that you can come up upon whiteness, even if it's kind of honorary whiteness. Is that something that, is that a sentiment that you've come across with other people you've spoken about with, about this issue, that there's a feeling that in the process of trying to gain that validation from dominant society, you kind of have to distance yourself from that black identity, and the way you do that is by degrading or by trying to, you know, even figuratively and literally marry into the other you know, group, so to speak?
I would definitely agree to that point. I think that it's something where when you assimilate, I think that we, honestly, we live in an aesthetically pleasing world. If you look good, or everything is based off of stereotypes. If you make a certain type, amount of money, if you look a certain type of way, then societally you move up in the world. And even though that's not the way that we wish that things work, that is the way that things work. And as black people, we're at an even lower notch on that totem pole when it comes to societal standards. So I think that when we look at the community, we have a whole different side of that spectrum where we are looking inward from a whole different spectrum. There's a way that we're looking at each other from skin color perspectives, or, you know, the way that we look, or how much, what we're wearing, or things that are just so trivial that at the end of the day, they start to create an even bigger feud between black people as a whole. And I think that it's something where when you start to assimilate, like you were referencing, assimilation is the biggest way that I think we find ourselves losing ourselves in a way. So I don't know if I specifically answered your question correctly, but I would definitely agree to the point that you were making.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you say then that in this quest, I guess, for validation and really what it is, social capital, that considering, you know, the history of this country and where it's placed white people socioeconomically, if they're seen as higher status and you want to increase your status, that that can propel black males and black females to try to distance themselves from other black people, because in order to do that, they have to make themselves more proximal to the higher status people who they perceive as white people. So they have to kind of drop their connection or deny any connection to the quote unquote black aspect of themselves. Would you agree to that?
I definitely would. I think it happens in the way that maybe you see people interact with other people in their tone. That's definitely a big example. Some people communicate differently when they're in a setting of Black professionals versus white professionals, and that just speaks to the same sentiment that you're touching on. And I definitely think that people find themselves losing aspects of their Blackness in order to try and maintain social order and to maintain a sense of self-worth in a world of whiteness, which is so very hard to find that sense of balance because it's been perpetuated on us through the media and through just standards of living and the way that we've been indoctrined through either our education systems or just daily living. So I think that it's very hard to for the average person to try and kind of find that happy medium between existing in a society that hasn't made the best strides forward in that aspect, but also trying to stay true to yourself in the same light.
Right. And when you say changing behavioral patterns in different environments, you're referring to, you know, something like code switching, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Gotcha.
Can I get clear? Can I bring in clarity?
Absolutely.
Without bringing a wrench on the table, Brother Mike?
Absolutely.
Sure.
And looking at the conversation, we's or no we's, where when we talk about Afro-American women and Afro-American men and going into corporate America now, Afro-American women make anything they put on look good. We understand that. But the beauty of the weave going into corporate America, I'm not a female, I'm a male, and I'm curious on, for the self-esteem of the Afro-American woman, rocking the weave versus rocking her natural scenic appeal that she has in her being able to make herself look beautiful without the extras. Now, I understand everybody wears weaves, and I understand that Afro-American women look very, very good in weaves or wigs or anything that they put on, and they style it. So is the weave a part of assimilating, or is the weave with the style that Afro-American women put on it, is it something totally different? Or should Afro-American women, if they really are centric to Afro-Americans, should they only rock their hair natural and leave the other for someone else to wear?
Well, speaking from a female perspective, in corporate or business settings, I have not only confined myself to wearing weaves in settings like that. I've worn my hair in buns, but also when I think about the aesthetic of the style, have I slicked my hair down to have a more a polished standard that could be perceived through a lens of whiteness? Sure. And I think that that comes from a history of seeing it be done. I have a plethora of professional Black women in my family, and I wouldn't say that they all have worn weaves. I think that they have all worn their natural hair at certain points in time. And I think that it's also a personal choice, because when we look at the perception of Black women in society, we're already deemed lower for anything we do. So I think when it comes to our hair, a lot of women wear weaves as protective styles, not because they're ashamed of their natural hair, but because they're trying to protect the beauty of their natural hair when they do decide that they want to wear it. So I think that it's not something where people necessarily feel ashamed when they're in the comfort of white, or not in the comfort, when they're in white spaces. I don't think that necessarily concealing your natural hair means that you're denying your Blackness. I think that sometimes it means that you understand the spaces you're in, and we're in a place where now Black hairstyles such as dreadlocks or even just natural preferences are not allowed in a lot of different workspaces, even in 2021. So I think that it's something that definitely needs to be addressed. But I also think that there are strides being made to where I see a lot of natural hair professionals in the media that are showing their way of representation. So I know that Kaiasia could probably attest to this topic as well as a black female, but that's just my two cents on it.
Definitely. And we're actually going to bring in Kaiasia here in a second. I just wanted to add a little bit to that before I give the floor to Kaiasia, and I'll ask her the same question I initially asked you, and she can give her response to that and her thoughts on, you know, the conversation that's has been unfolding so far. I just want to say, because I know this is a controversial issue and it should be talked about, when it comes to weaves and other forms of, you know, changing your appearance for females and males, I think that having some psychological literacy would do us well here, because even if you aren't consciously aware of it, in fact, that's how propaganda usually operates, if it's effective most of the time, which is unconsciously, even if you aren't consciously aware of it, a lot of the propaganda that has been pushed onto people worldwide, not just black people, in terms of the Eurocentric standard of beauty, has seeped into the subconscious minds of people, and more than likely is actually propelling people to take up certain practices, especially certain cosmetic practices, for reasons of certain psychological insecurities that that person either may or may not be consciously aware of. So certainly you have people who, let's say, don weaves who aren't doing it because they're expressing a subconscious insecurity they've gotten from, you know, centuries of being immersed in Eurocentric propaganda about beauty standards. Certainly you have people out there who aren't affected by it, but I would say I'd be willing to bet that most of the people who do, whether they are consciously aware of it or not, subconsciously they probably have a lot of insecurities that have been implanted into them through media, through propaganda. And anyone listening, I'd recommend you look up something called the Mere Exposure Effect, M-E-R-E, Exposure Effect, or also it's called the Familiarity Principle, but probably Google the Mere Exposure Effect, and this will help you understand a little bit more why I'm coming from this position, why I think that most of the time people who do wear, you know, women who do wear weaves probably are, unbeknownst to themselves, expressing some programs, some propagandistic programs that have been put into their subconscious mind by the Eurocentric, you know, global media machine that's been promoting images of beauty as being a fair-skinned, you know, European woman with straight hair. I just would recommend people look up the Mere Exposure Effect. But what that is, though, briefly, and then I'll get Kaiasia on here. German psychologist by the name of Gustav Fechner, around 1876, he was one of the first people to discover that if you show an animal, especially, you know, a human, it can work with other animals, though, dogs, cats, rats. If you show them something over and over again, or you expose them to something over and over again, eventually, after a certain amount of exposures, their initial reaction was usually somewhat fear-based. When you expose someone something to someone new, and, you know, you check their heart rate, you check their blood pressure, you check their cortisol levels, there's a little bit of stress because it's new and it's different. But if you expose it to that organism over time, it flips, where they begin to develop a preference for that thing on a subconscious level just because you've exposed it to them over and over again at a certain frequency. And they'll actually prefer the things that you've exposed to them a lot more than the other things in their environment that they're exposed to regularly. They're not exposed to at some elevated frequency or some elevated rate. And I know it certainly has been proven that with the Eurocentric media we have, if you show people lighter skin tones more often in media and TV shows, and any kind of media, music videos, subconsciously they start to become more attracted to what they see the most. So they'll start to be more attracted to lighter skins. Same thing goes in reverse, by the way, which is kind of somewhat what's happening out now with greater media representation of black people. If you expose people to darker skin tones over and over again, especially when they're young girls and young boys, they'll grow up with a greater attraction to whatever the skin color that you're exposing them to the most is. And this also works with other features like, you know, facial features, wide noses, thin noses. So I think this is just something we have to keep in mind, even if consciously, you know, we think or we think someone else we know isn't consciously making the decision to wear, let's say, a weave because of insecurities instilled into them because through Eurocentric media and white supremacy. I think we should be conscious of the fact that a lot of the times it's subconscious, and media is the primary way in which you can get people to be attracted to certain things, unattracted to other things, and, you know, instill those beliefs within themselves. But I'll give you a chance to respond to that, Dr. Ken. I want to get Kaija on here, though, before we go further. If Kaija is on the line, I'd like to ask her again so I can get her into this conversation. I'm guessing you probably do, but do you think that there is a noticeable conflict in the relationships between black males and females in America, generally speaking? And if so, why, in your opinion, Kaija? Do we have Kaija on the line?
Still here.
All right, can you hear me? Can you hear me okay,
yeah.
Kaija? Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you that question again. Do you believe that there is noticeable conflict in the relationships between black males and females in America, generally speaking? And if so, why, in your opinion?
Yes, I do. Basically, I totally agree with Taylor, but I'm going to go off of what she said. I feel like it's a lot of things that go into play with it, like a lot of unknown trauma, bad communication. And the thing that I see the most is mostly like competing. It seems like they compete with each other more than actually trying to be together.
Okay, most definitely. When it comes to this competing, what do you think they're competing for? Money, social capital, both, one or the other?
Totally honest, it could be pride, it could be a defense mechanism, it could be a number of things.
Okay. Well, in your opinion, based on your personal experience, what have you personally seen is the prize that both parties are competing for in most of these competitions you're seeing between black males and females? Is it, you know, monetary, trying to you know, make more money than the other person, trying to gain more connections, trying to gain more political favor, more validation from, you know, outside groups, validation from the opposite sex, the same sex? In your opinion, what do you see as being the main prize that both of these, you know, sides of the community are competing for, in your opinion?
In my opinion, there is no prize, but I feel like it will be the validation part that people go looking for.
Validation from who or what, would you say, in your opinion?
What do you mean by who or what?
Well, validation,
like,
usually
by outsiders or by each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you see there? What are they trying to gain validation from?
From personal experience, I would say from each other. But then I have seen some relationships where it's from, like, they want validation from outsiders. Like, they care about too much what other people think and not focusing on their relationship.
Definitely. In the cases you've observed or have experience with where it seems like they're trying to gain validation from each other, is this, would you say, related to, like, insecurities they have about their own self-worth and they think they need to prove that they're worthy to the other party by doing something?
And no. Well, yes, but that's not all. Like, I feel like, yeah, it's insecurities, but I also feel like it's past undealt with trauma, like undealt with pain, and they're just, like, living through that.
Definitely. Do you think that, and I'll ask you, this is just, you can give your own personal opinion, and I can speak a little bit more on the scientific side of this. Do you think that, let's say, trauma can be inherited intergenerationally?
Yes.
Okay, definitely. And the reason why I ask that is because I do have a little bit of scientific literacy on that. I mentioned before on a different conversation I was a part of, I can't remember if it was on this show or if it was on another show or meeting that I was a part of, epigenetics. Are you familiar with what epigenetics is?
No.
Okay. Well, genetics, you know, A, C, T, G, you've got your DNA in your body that has the instructions for how to build your body. That's your genetics, your actual, you know, chemical information written out, your code. What epigenetics is a relatively recent scientific field that's been created based on some recent discoveries, like that happened in the early 2000s, maybe late, at the most, late 1990s, early 2000s, in which basically a lot of genetic researchers discovered that if you take animals like humans, but the ones they start out experimenting on are rats, and you do something like you take a male rat, you expose it to a certain fruity smelling chemical that this male rat would usually in the wild like and find pleasant and go towards because they'd probably assume that there's food somewhere around there. You expose them to this pleasant chemical, but every single time you expose this rat to this pleasant fruity smelling chemical, you shock them. You give them an electric shock so that you kind of invert their perception in a way so they now associate pain and stress with something that naturally they should associate with pleasure, this fruity smelling chemical. And if you do that over and over again to this male mouse, and then you take sperm from that male mouse and you use that sperm to impregnate a female mouse, and you never let the children of that female mouse come into contact with that male mouse, what you'll find is even though the male mouse didn't have any contact with the kids, you strap the child mouse, if you will, into the chair, expose him to the same fruity chemicals. And remember, he didn't have any socialization with the father mouse. You put him in the chair, expose him to the same fruity chemicals, and they have a fear response to it, almost like they were taught that or like they inherited that fear response to that stimulus, that fruity smelling chemical, even though, like I said, they didn't have any connection with the father mouse. It was in vitro fertilization. And that was some of the early work that was done to show that not only do we, you know, pass on our DNA to our progeny, our kids, but we can also pass on chemical tags that attach to the DNA that tells the DNA how to respond to an external stimulus. Meaning if you see this image, this is, for instance, how people can kind of pass down what seems like phobias, fears of certain things. These chemical tags that you can pass down tell your DNA, if you see this thing, if you hear this thing, if you smell this thing, this stimulus, you should produce this chemical in the body as a response. In which case, in the case of the rat, that experiment, it was a cortisol, stress chemical. So when I mentioned intergenerational trauma inheritance, and you said you also believe that, that's something that's been validated scientifically now. And obviously that has a big impact on Black people, given, you know, what Black people have gone through in terms of Jim Crow and slavery and all that. That likely has a lot to do with explaining why people, not just Black people, but why people react to certain things in the way that they do, even if they don't have any prior experience. Like if this is your first time seeing a spider, you're 5 years old and you're seeing, and this is your first time seeing a spider, and you freak out, your adrenaline shoots up. It's probably because, you know, one of your ancestors maybe had a not so pleasant experience with the spider and actually passed down that chemical tag on their DNA that tells your DNA how their descendants should react to this stimulus, to this image of seeing a spider in the future. So that was just a little tidbit of information I wanted to throw in there.
So Mike, if we would say with that understanding, looking at the relationships between Black men and Black women being the conversation tonight, if we would say that if anything we may have inherited through our families is how we communicate with each other on sensitive issues. In a lot of our families, we've hollered, screamed, we tore each other down, dealt with each other very unprofessional, and I could see how bad communication skills can come through our families and wreck our families. For instance, when we look at relationships between men and women, period, and then when we look particularly at in the Afro-American family, if a man, and going back to the hair, to his significant other, and says something about her hair, if he has a preference for her to take it natural or into a weave, as a man, does he have that right to communicate that? And how could he communicate that without offending the relationship? If what the Afro-American woman, for her self-esteem in corporate America, many young girls have been attacked in school about their hair, and if this is something that the man may not understand, she needs to wear this, or she for her self-esteem, how does she communicate that and not feel bad about that or good about that? The other thing is, can he also speak to her weight? Can a man in a relationship, can a father speak to his daughter about her weight in a situation and not wreck the relationship? When we understand that how we communicate can be inherited down, so if my mama wouldn't let my daddy talk to her about her weight, and that was a problem, or how she wore her hair, even though the weave was good for her, he couldn't stand it. And if that would bring a wedge between the relationship, where is the give? Where's the middle ground here, particularly when it can cause problems in that relationship? So I'm saying, when we look at using the example of critical, I'm just using the weave and the weight as examples. I don't have any problems with that whatsoever. But using those is, normally those are hot buttons in relationships. And depending on how the man expresses to the woman about her weight, it can cause non-communication for a couple of days, and it can cause her to say, well, forget it, and just, you know, a lot of, so I guess if the question tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is about how do we keep our communication intact so we can talk about critical, simple family issues so we don't have to look at each other. If the woman really don't want to be called a bitch, how can she make that known? Her daddy didn't call her that, but if she's arguing and fussing with this man in that manner, then how does he perceive that? All of us have, you know, histories of watching it done bad, but some of us have histories of watching it done well. So I'm saying, if the question is about the communication about Afro-American men and women, we got some stuff inherited. How do we change this narrative so our grandchildren can do it better? And we can be a people that have proven that we can communicate and get along in the community. I want to keep that on the table, sir.
Definitely. And I'll let the two ladies speak more on this than I will. I'll just say something briefly. I'll give my response. Firstly, I think the gist of what you're saying is, how do we effectively communicate things to each other that we think may spur conflict or that we may disagree on? And how do we do that while trying to manage or deal with things that may trigger us that come out of that? Like, if we're communicating something that maybe does go back to someone's trauma and we're saying something that might trigger them, how do we effectively, you know, deal with that, deal with triggering people in that way? I'll just say, first of all, you asked, do men have a right to, you know, ask or speak about weave or something like that? I'll say everyone has a right to express their opinion, and the other person has their right to express their opinion back and decide whether or not they want to, you know, listen to that opinion and integrate that information and use it or not. I'll also say, though, that offenses come, but they don't have to be taken. And what I mean by that is a lot of times when people take offense to certain things that other people say, even if they are specifically derogatory or the attempt is to abase someone else, which most of the time I don't think that's the case in terms of relationships. If someone says something and another person responds to it negatively, I don't think most of the time the person who said it probably meant that to spur that conflict. But what I'll say is, in terms of what I mean by offenses come, but they don't have to be taken, when we respond negatively to something that someone else says, that usually means subconsciously we believe it. So if someone calls you a word you don't like and you respond negatively emotionally, it's one thing to say like, hey, don't call me that. That's not my name. I don't like that. You can make that, you can articulate that. But if you respond emotionally, if you lose control for a second and get mad maybe, and you didn't want to get mad, you would have rather like to communicate that you don't want to be called that name without having gotten emotional or losing your temper. Usually when you do lose your temper or get emotional, that's because subconsciously you believe what they said about you or you believe what they called you. So in order to make sure that when offenses come, they're not taken, you have to first kind of dig deep into your own subconscious mind and make sure you don't secretly believe some of the negative things that people are saying about you, or some of the negative stereotypes that are associated to things people are saying to you that they're not even trying to attack you with. Like if they're saying, hey, I think you should wear your natural hair, you don't have to listen to me if you don't, you know, it's just my opinion. You can take it or leave it, perfectly fine. But, you know, I think you should do this or that. When you hear those things, if you respond negatively, if you get angry, I think you stop and say, well, hold on, what must I believe to be true about myself in order to feel this negative emotion? Because if someone says, for instance, I think you should, or if someone calls you, I'll say a made-up word. If someone calls you an escuda, you don't really know what the word escuda means. You don't respond to it. If I say, hey, you're an escuda, you're not really going to respond emotionally. And that's kind of the space you want to be in whenever anybody talks to you, whenever they give criticism, whenever they give their opinion, or whenever they call you something. That's what you want to feel, that emptiness that you feel when I call you an escuda, because you don't have a belief, a subconscious belief that tells you what escuda means and whether or not you think you are that subconsciously. So I think if we ask ourselves what subconscious beliefs or insecurities we have, like if you call someone the B word and they respond to it negatively, and I don't mean them saying like, hey, don't call me that, that's not my name, and them articulating why they don't want you to call you that. I mean, if they are unable to articulate that as well as they'd like to because they get emotional, that would be, I think, a good time for them to say, well, wait a minute, what do I believe about myself that would make me feel as if them calling me this is actually accurate of me? I don't, because I'm only reacting this way due to the fact hold on one second, Mr. Cannon. At some level, when you react emotionally to something someone says to you, you're saying that, you know, that attack on you was successful. And the only reason it was successful is because they said something that you believe about yourself. So you have to ask yourself, you know, if someone calls me a name, even the N-word, if you react extremely emotionally when someone calls you the N-word, subconsciously, any psychiatrist who's worth their weight in salt will tell you this. And this is usually because of, you know, centuries of, you know, white supremacist program, and I understand that. But usually that's because subconsciously you probably believe that you are that, unfortunately, because of the programming you've been subjected to. That's why you react emotionally to it. You can't really have an emotional reaction to something you don't have a belief in. So that's what I would say.
Well, I think initially, yeah, we was talking about relationships.
So it's self-worth.
Even if we took it beyond that, let's say in the corporate America, let's say if a supervisor says you look better or you look nice with your natural hair, that could be a racial case If I said to a young man that was working for me, young man, you know, pull your pants up, if he figures that's a part of his culture, we started talking about that chip on the shoulder. If I go into corporate America with that chip in the shoulder and I don't assimilate, I'm not going to pull my pants up. I get offended and now I want a case against you because you're coming against my heritage. Or if a woman gets offensive and she says that's sexual harassment because you made mention about my hair looks better natural and I was offended and she could bring a case, we started off talking too about that chip on the shoulder. So I guess what I'm saying, using these only as examples, I don't have a problem with women wearing weed. I don't have a problem with none of that. Yeah, but my point is using those as an example as hot buttons that a person may carry on their shoulder. A person may have a legitimate reason why he's walking around with his pants down. But if I mention it and I say something and he's up under my employment, okay, depending on how I say it. So my question is whether we in relationships, men and women, or we in corporate America, and we have to talk about sensitive real subject, and we're just starting with these here, you know. But my and understanding that people got hot buttons, okay, one of the most sensitive one, if a man say to his woman, listen, you getting a little heavy, you getting a little, you know, it can shatter her self-esteem, okay, he didn't realize it, and so now, you know, she shut down on him. He don't understand. And so his secretary understand, and she, you know, is right there to listen. Well, I guess we're talking about relationships and trying to bring it back to that as well. And as we bring in our callers, hit one on the phone if you want to get in this conversation. But I guess what I'm saying is those sensitive subjects, whether it's in relationship or corporate America, if we go out there with a chip on our shoulder and we getting offended about everything, then we're not going to assimilate. We're going to get fired. You're going to sabotage good relationships that's brought into your life because you got issues that can't nobody talk to you about, and they can't be talked about, and you shut down instead of opening it up because that might be inherited from what you've seen your parents do. And so now today we got these real issues. So the question is, how do we as Afro-American men and women pull together with these issues and create a stronger front before the world, Brother Mike?
And I'll have, you know, Taylor and Kaija come in here and, you know, they can respond to what my personal opinion is on this, you know, and you can feel free to disagree. Anyone on the panel, feel free to disagree. You don't have to, you know, appease anyone here. If you disagree with anything I say, you can feel free to disagree and explain why. I kind of agree with the sentiment that you're espousing, Dr. Ken. You know, my focus on, I'll use racism as an example. My focus on dealing with racism is not, and I'll be honest, it's not a politically left of center social justice focus. My focus is more so on money, on resources, reparations, things that we're owed. I don't really care that much about going to the Grammys or caring about the Grammys or caring about anything that's white and trying to gain validation from it. I care more so about getting black people their due, their money, so that they can go build their own institutions, their own Grammys. So I'm not someone who's particularly partial to this. And it is propaganda, the propaganda campaign that's been waged upon black people by people who are politically left of center in this country. Both sides have, you know, propaganda. I'm not taking the right side of this politically. I have issues with both sides, but one of the things that the people left of center of this country have done, particularly white people, white leftists, is hypersensitize black people specifically to what I think is the wrong kind of issue, right? If someone calls you a name, I really think it's useless to waste your energy responding emotionally to something that is not yours, right? If they put a label on you like the N-word and they say it, unless it's coming like with a physical threat and you have to defend yourself, go ahead and do that. Unless it's coming with something attached to it like that, if it's just a word and you respond emotionally, I think you should take the time to step back and say, well, hold on, wait a minute. What subconscious belief do I have that makes me think that's true for me to respond emotionally to that, like I've been successfully hit? So I don't really focus on, you know, if someone says in your place of work, hey, I think you should wear your hair naturally, or hey, I think you should wear your hair like this. If a white person says that, I don't really respond emotionally to that because I haven't been hypersensitized to what I think.
And
yeah,
they don't mean no offense by it, but they
right.
know for your promotion that might be in your betterment, and now you have an opportunity to file a lawsuit, or you haven't. Is that a just conversation, or should you just stay out of that? I think,
and then I'll have Kaija and Taylor give the two thoughts. My personal opinion, I think that's an after effect of programming that we've been, or propaganda that we've been subjected to from a certain faction of this country's political party that intentionally wanted to hypersensitize black people in kind of a social justice way to distract them from economic justice for their, you know, problems like reparations. Wants us more focused on words or things that people said, tweets people sent out, rather than, you know, resources and money. Dealing with racism systematically, as an example, I think these people would rather us deal with it on an individual social justice level. And so they've kind of created a propaganda campaign that over decades has hypersensitized black people and black youth to certain things they don't need to be hypersensitized to. It doesn't mean you have to agree with a white person, for instance, calling you the N-word. It just means I don't really see any reason why you would get emotional, why you would cry, why you would do anything like that to something someone else projects onto you, unless you subconsciously believe it. Even if someone says like, hey, I think you should cut your dreads, not on a racist way, or even if it was racist, but let's say they were saying, hey, I think you should cut your dress, or I think you should do this because I've noticed that when black people interview with this company and they look this way instead of this way, they get hired more often, and I want you to get hired more often. I'm trying to give you some game. You can accept that or you cannot accept it. I think you should just see it for what it is, which is words, right? If it's just words, there isn't really any reason for you to respond to words with emotion. So I think that's a side effect of a hypersensitization campaign that's been put on black people to get them to react more to social justice kind of situations instead of focusing more on dealing with discrimination in a systematic way in the economic system of America. Taylor and Kaija, you can jump in here
so,
and you can give your two thoughts.
I guess I can go from both different spectrums. I think that there's parts of what you just said, Michael, that I can definitely agree with when it comes to programming. And I think that that is an aspect of the answer to a lot of the questions of what we just discussed. When it comes to hair, I just want to touch on that quickly because I think it's also very trivial. I think that things such as education and preserving the mental health of black females and black males is far more important than worrying about their weight or worrying about what they choose to sew or glue into their hair as far as being a black woman. So as far as their hair, with men wanting to make comments regarding a woman's hair, I believe that a woman's hair is part of her autonomy. I believe that that's part of her body. If I told a man that I wanted him to strictly wear waves and to never have his hair be in a natural state or in dreads or in braids or some sort, then that's me kind of interjecting on his personal right. And I think that that's the same thing with black women. If you feel as though I must wear my natural hair, let's talk about the maintenance. I think that that's one aspect that, and they don't think that they mean to intentionally, but black men with not dealing with black hair and not being black women, I don't think they understand the maintenance and the time that goes into it, and not necessarily that it comes from a standpoint of I don't want to wear my natural hair because I'm insecure. It's more so it's so time consuming to preserve your natural hair, to keep it healthy, to make sure that not that it looks good to the standards of the white gaze, but to make sure that it's healthy and to make sure that it's being taken care of. I think that there's so much time that black men may not be aware of that goes into our hair, that as far as maintenance and as far as maintaining how it looks, and not in a standard of aesthetically pleasing, but just, again, keeping it healthy and making sure that your natural hair doesn't break off. So I think that that's an aspect of why we wear wigs and weaves that a lot of people don't understand. And understanding that there's far more, even though wigs and weaves have gone up exponentially when it comes to price, there's a lot of money and time that goes into wearing your natural hair and getting the right products and making sure that your hair is correct. So I think that when it comes to Black women, what we choose to do with our hair is up to our own discernment. It's our hair. And if our men want to interject, I understand that it can come from a place of love and from a place of admiration for the beauty that it, that our hair holds, but also understanding that if you're not willing to sit up and detangle my hair with me and to make sure my cornrows are greased up, then what are we really doing here when it comes to you feeling control of my hair or even my weight? Just to touch on that simply, there's men out here that love Lizzo's and there's men out here that love Rihanna's, and you can take that how you want to take that. But I believe that harping on a woman for the way that her weight has fluctuated, either gained or lost weight, I believe that there's a honest and a gentle way to go about it from a health concern and from a genuine sentiment of concern for that person. But if you're coming from a standpoint of you don't meet my needs anymore or you don't look good for me anymore, then I think that that's a place of ego, and that's a place where you need to set aside, am I with this person for the right reasons, or am I wanting them to uphold a standard and be on a pedestal that they never asked or signed up to be on in the first place? So I think that there are certain ways to go about interjecting in certain relationships, and especially when it comes to corporate, like it was mentioned, lawsuits and such can be brought up in that aspect. So that's something to be very careful with. But just in a general human aspect, I think that we care far too much about people's outside exteriors when the interior is really what controls the trajectory of how we're going to have the betterment of the community. But that's just my sentiments, and anyone can chime in or disagree as well.
Most definitely, absolutely. And I'll have Kaija come in here. I just wanted to say that part of the reason I ask that, or the main reason really I ask that, and even play a little bit of devil's advocate for positions that I may not be completely aligned with, is to oftentimes elicit responses from articulate people such as yourself as a demonstration of how you actually respond to something like what I said, what Dr. Cannon said, which is kind of the point of the discussion. Even if you disagree with something we said, or, you know, are at least kind of playing devil's advocate, pretending to support a position which we're pretending to support right now to get a certain response. Even if you disagree with that position, the way you articulated it is preferably the way that men and women should articulate the disagreements they have in perspective with other people, instead of, you know, the more hysterical side we see of men and women, where, or really the, of human nature, you know, when you visibly start to get a little bit more agitated and angry and people start yelling. I think what you just displayed is an excellent, cogent, articulate, intelligent response to a perspective that you may not share. And that's kind of the whole point of this, is when people come at you with opinions of their own, most often not intentionally malicious, or statements, that you respond to it kind of how you just did, in an articulate way, and basically saying, you know, I either agree with this or I don't agree with it. That's not for me. I can incorporate this into my worldview. I'm not interested in incorporating that. And, you know, that's fine. That's great. So I appreciate that response, a very measured response, and a good example of how you, I think you should engage with different opinions and different ideas of other people.
I appreciate that. I think that rationale and respect go hand in hand. So I just try and look at it again from both perspectives, but also understanding the way that I want to carry myself in my life. And that differs for everyone. Again, like you touched on as well, everyone has the choice in whether or not they want to pander into societal projections, whether that be from a personal standpoint or from a corporate or media standpoint. So
absolutely. Kaija, do you have any thoughts on any of this? Do you agree or disagree with any of this? And do you want to, you know, address anything anyone said? Do we have Kaeja on the line? You might have to, Kaeja, if you're on the line, you can hear me. You might have to press 1 in order for you to get into the conversation. Do we still have Kaeja? Okay.
Until she get back in, you know, if we could, as I steer the conversation and we look at, you know, I guess the inner workings of communication and using again the weave and the way, and they are trivial, definitely trivial issues, but the conversation and dealing with, you know, the Afro-American male and female and relationships, and to my pivot point, it would be how we communicate with each other with difficult issues. You know, if even in wearing a weave, and I'm not charming on that, but I am, if that's a costume that is worn by women to build their self-esteem, and because it's less expensive to roll that way than with their natural, then it's a great conversation, but we have that understanding. But if we're talking about a relationship with the man who may and may not know that is your hair and not your hair, and then to be pleasantly surprised at whatever period of time that what you presented, what the woman presented, was not what she was. Now, we all put on costumes, and this is true. We go into corporate America with costumes. We present ourselves to people with costumes. So I'm saying, but if this is something that's, when you put this on, your attitude changes and you become a different person. Your accent changes, your speech changes. When you take it off, you then that's a costume. It's a uniform. And then so understanding when we have to talk about real issues about what you present to your man, you know, then do you give him the liberty to say, keep your costume for outside, but keep your natural for inside? Do we give him the liberty to speak to the weight? And these are simple examples. We can go into the women who've had abortions that wasn't able to communicate that with their mate until many years later. Women that were abused by their relative or abused by a man, and therefore it affects how they have their man be affectionate with them because they've got some secrets that they haven't been able to take that costume off. They haven't been able to open up and really share their heart of hearts, but yet they're in a 5-year relationship, 6-year relationship. It is true. All of us are damaged. All of us have this monkey on our back or these chips on our shoulders as we started out. And I guess as we learn to communicate on platforms like this and even in our families, as we cut off some of the televisions and communicate, where we can learn to communicate these hurts, whether it's weight, whether it's abortion, whether it's he blew the money, gambled the money, or smoked the money, or drunk the money, where we don't destroy each other, but we can talk about these sensitive conversations. My observations in my 58 years is that when you get to certain sensitive conversations, people clam up. And you may try once or twice, and if they clam up 2 or 3 times, then you back off and you never dive into that again, and that thing takes a root of bitterness or a root into our lives that's never rooted up, and it affects how we go out and how we communicate with people on a day-to-day basis. Some may call it a chip on the shoulder, or it may be a bid for attention or whatever, but I think when we're clear about what we're doing, when I can say, no, that's just a accent that I use, or that's just a uniform that I put on, but that's not who I am in my heart of hearts. So I think when men and women, black men, white men, whoever, white women, okay, women, period, and men, period. But when we're talking about an Afro-American family, well, we've got some additional hurts and pains through slavery, through Jim Crow, through 400 years of devastation. We come to the 21st century, and we want to be able to communicate like everybody else. And so I'm saying when women drop their rocks and their sensitivity and they allow the man to talk about some of those sensitive issues and they can share their heart of hearts with them and they don't have to go be as hard, then I think that's some of the answers, Brother Mike. And that's what I just – my thing is when we're talking about relationships in corporate America and within our families, we've got to learn to communicate better.
Absolutely, most definitely. I have the text open up the phone lines here in a second. I'll just say one thing to that, Dr. Cannon, because I agree with a lot of what you said. The main reason really for having this conversation isn't really to focus so much on the answers people give to the questions posed, because all the answers are subjective. They're just all of our opinions. Really what people, I hope they're observing or they become more consciously aware of, which they're probably already subconsciously, you know, observing and taking in, is not so much the answers given to the questions, because like I said, those are subjective, but rather the composure and how people are responding to questions and statements that other people are making that they may not agree with or that they just may not share in their worldview. That's really the what we're really trying to get across here, because sometimes we play devil's advocate, and devil's advocate is a very important position to play, not necessarily because, you know, you believe the position, that's what devil's advocate is about, but more so to challenge your own conception, your own ideas, to see if there are flaws in the way in which you think, and even more importantly, I think, to get a sense of how people respond to opposing views. That's really the purpose here. For people to see how we're responding, how we're communicating, because this is an example of how you can actually repair the relationship damage through better communication. You can learn how to, you know, put together coherent and measured responses and articulate yourself well in response to people with different opinions. So this is actually an example of how you repair some of those communicational deficits that hinder relationships, how we're speaking right now, how we're communicating right now over things that we agree with and don't agree with. Do you have something short you wanted to say, Dr. Cannon? Because I do need to open up the lines here.
Yeah, let's open up the lines. I mean, I think we were talking about still relationships as much as possible and how we do them better, how we communicate better, how we flow the better. We know we got a lot of inherited stuff inside of us, but irregardless, where's the answers?
Absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, you brought up those really contentious issues of weaves and weight. Like you said, not because you really believe those issues are anything more than trivial, but for a good reason, to play devil's advocate, just to kind of
poke the audience. Those are hot buttons. Those destroy communication. And
right.
If you can't communicate about those things, how do you get into the deep things?
Exactly. That's a good gauge to bring those things up, not necessarily because you think they're important to obsess over someone's weight, but to gauge how people are going to respond and react to it, if they can put together coherent, measured responses to it. So if people look a little bit more deeply into what we're doing, they'll kind of see a little bit more of the genius what we're really trying to do here. We're really trying to put on a display of you know, controlling yourself and responding to positions you may not agree with in a measured way, and using that in relationships to strengthen your communication between, you know, all parties involved. If I could get the text to open up the phone lines, anyone who is in the queue or anyone who wants to speak on the show, you just have to tap 1 on your phone and the text will open up the phone line and allow you to speak. Do we have anyone currently who is waiting to speak? Is anyone on the line? Okay, I was told earlier we had Dr. Tynes on the line. I don't know if he's still on the line. Are you still on the line? Can you hear us? Okay, I'm being told there's no one on the line. So we can keep going. If there is someone on the line, or if someone in the listening audience wants to get in on the show, again, all you have to do is just tap one on your phone, and you will be put into a queue, and, you know, we'll give you an opportunity to speak your mind. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Cannon.
Is that Dr. Chimes coming in?
Oh, no, that was me. You can go ahead.
In communicating tough issues in relationships, I don't know if I'm steering it in the right direction. Hit one on the phone, ladies and gentlemen, because, you know, my question would be, Mike, you know, and two, you know, is there ever a time where a man can say to his woman in relationships, honey, be quiet, or stronger, shut up, or, you know, is there a time where the line is crossed where the man has to, if we're talking about relationships, if we're talking about why they work, why they don't work, why, and I'm just giving observations that if the mate is going overboard and is getting dangerous, and the man has to step up and be a man and say to his woman, does he have the authority at that point to where there's not going to be a turnaround fight between him and her? I'm asking, again, we're talking about relationships, and we're talking about why they don't work, and I guess we could almost do a whole series in my mind of you know, black men, black women relationships that's really male and female relationships. I think it's all adaptable to all cultures and races, but I think a lot of it is respect and communication. And whether I'm your employee and you find a father that's professional, he goes to work, he deals with his employees in a professional way, he comes home, he teaches that professionalism and communication to his family so they communicate with each other a little better, versus a father that never learned it, he hollers, screams, fusses. A mother that hollers, screams, fusses, the child learns that, as we talked about earlier, and so they mimic that same behavior in communication, or they shut down. You can't shut down in a professional environment. You got to go have a one-on-one. But if we don't have the one-on-ones in our families, if a man and a woman, if a woman can shut down and stop the communication with the hope, that's going to make the communication better. You know, she's not going to talk to the man. She's going to go talk to her girlfriends, her group, and that's going to make their communication better. When the person, if we're talking about male, female, Afro-American men, Afro-American relationships, she has to turn back to him, and no matter how painful if it is, if he says, honey, sugar, sweetie, you need to exercise, you gained 150 pounds, you know, with not being disrespectful, but if he has to come to a point where he has to be dogmatic, how does he be dogmatic without hurting the feelings? And vice versa. My point is, if she has to come and say, honey, there's an odor that comes from you, and it's strange, and you need to deal with it, and without him getting offended, how do he handle that? I'm just saying, when we're talking about tough conversation in families, male-female relationships, if we don't learn how to do it, my experience is people shut down and they sabotage good relationships that could be a blessing to them, but they sabotage it. And Mike, like you said, it could be some stuff inherited because that's what they saw their parents do. They do the same thing, and it is perpetuated throughout their family, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll let Taylor offer a longer response to this. I'll offer my two cents briefly. One of the first things you said is something to the effect of, does a man have a, basically the authority or the ability to say something. I forgot what. I'll just say anyone, you know, male or female, everyone has the right to express their opinion. I don't think that the expression of that opinion should come with the expectation that the other person or the other people you're communicating your opinion to have to, you know, care about your opinion or do what you say they want, you want them to do or consider. I think they really only owe you, you know, what you're owed in the legal system, which is free speech, right? You have the ability to express yourself as long as you're not, you know, like making a threat or something. You're not saying you're going to attack someone or kill someone. You have free speech. So, a man can say what he wants to say. A female can say what she wants to say. A woman can say what she wants to say. Neither should expect that the other has to obey what they say like a slave. But, yeah, both parties should recognize the free speech that they both, you know, possess in this country. And for the most part, I'd say around the world, although some countries maybe not so much free speech. Yeah, when it comes to how to communicate things that, you know, might be contentious, again, I just would bring that back to checking your subconscious beliefs. If you respond to certain things emotionally, negatively, you should ask yourself why. You know, why am I responding to this like this? If I disagree with it, you know, I can just say I disagree with that and it's not a part of my worldview. Well, I don't need to, you know, flare up. So you should probably ask yourself why you're reacting so strongly to it.
But because she gained 150 pounds,
right? But when you communicate that, when you communicate that to, when you communicate that to her, here's the thing about people. You can say that to her. You can say, hey, and I'm using your hypothetical, and that's the kind of extreme case. Obviously 150 pounds is gonna, if you say, hey, you gain 150 pounds, and
I
she
don't
says,
like the weave perturbs me every time I see the weave. I want to go, no matter how beautiful you style it, every time I see it, I want you to go in the bathroom and take it off.
Right, and you're perfectly fine.
You're
perfectly fine with expressing that. Absolutely, I'll defend your right to express it, your free speech, and she's perfectly fine with expressing how she feels back and choosing whether or not she wants to incorporate your opinion or her and your criticism into her worldview and act upon it or not act upon it. But I want to ask Taylor what her response is to that and what she thinks of that.
Okay, so a lot of what's being spoken upon feels, I don't know, maybe it's, so these are personal issues that can go on within different relationships, but I think on something I said earlier is their relationships also rely on respect, and I think that on this call and probably as listeners, we're all adults here, and I think that that's a big issue when it comes to Black male and female relationships and just relationships in general, regardless of race, is that there's a lack of respect and a lack of accountability. And I'm not going to sit here and say that women don't have issues with being accountable, because we do, and so can men as well. And that also comes into a play in what we're talking about, in the sense of if you have these grievances towards your significant other or whatever it may be, because we've talked about preferences throughout this entire podcast basically, but we've talked about them on different spectrums, and I believe that in the corporate setting is what we were talking about, that's a choice. Unfortunately, we live in a society where a company, even though there can be lawsuits behind it, a company has the choice to, you know, make comments about their employers or anything that they want to do. Now is that that's up to that person whether or not they want to stay with that company because their rights have been inflicted upon or not. But when it comes to relationships, that's an even wider choice in my opinion. I believe if you have these type of grievances where the weight has caused you to be this upset about your partner, whoever it may be, then just leave them. I think that berating them to change themselves is beating a dead end, and I don't think that that necessarily is something where that's the Black female's issue as a whole, but that's just that particular relationship, and that if that person has made these types of lifestyle choices that you don't agree with, whether it be that she's wearing weave all the time, if she's not willing to take the weave out and do her own hair, which, again, like I brought up, I'm someone who I have currently, right now, as we're speaking, yes, I have a weave in my head, but throughout the past year, I would say, the whole pandemic, I've been wearing my own hair, whether it be pressed or naturally laid or whatever it may be. And that's a question I also had for Dr. Cannon, is what do you really define as natural? Because as a Black woman, there's so many different intricacies to natural hair. I'd like to ask, do you know about the curl patterns? Do you know about whether or not she has a 4A through C curl pattern? Or do you mean natural hair as far as it being silk pressed or being straight from a more Eurocentric standpoint? Because that's also a thing that I think gets misconstrued within the community, within Black women, in the way that we communicate with each other, and also the way that Black men perpetuate the way that we carry ourselves, is that what are we really looking at as natural hair? Because as a Black woman who's grown up in white and Black spaces, and at 24 years old, I've been patronized for wearing my hair when I feel 100% confident in it. And it's natural and it's curly state, and there's comments or even being taken to the point of my hair being touched and my personal space being evaded. So I think that there's so many different outliers to our hair that almost has become policed in this society, and our bodies as Black people are already policed enough. So I think that a lot of the different things that we're touched on right now are things that are pertaining to personal, to individual people and preferences, and something that Michael touched on as well, is that those are all choices, and that the people that we interact with are defined by our own personal preference. And if someone's not adhering to your standards, that's not necessarily something that is their fault, but that may be something where you need to change the direction of your life and who you have around you, so that you can feel more at ease with their standards of how they carry themselves.
That's a good question, Dr. Cannon. If I could, because she raised a good point, a good question. What do you define as natural hair? What's your response to that?
And I really don't know, but my question would be more directly, if we were in relationship and you have a weave in now, we're talking about male-female relationships, could I speak to that without offending you? Could you and I, if we were in relationship, would I have to tiptoe around the fact that, you know, I want you to go exercise, or I want you to think about changing your diet because you got issues, and I'm talking about, my point is, using these as only examples. We could do a whole show on hair, whole show on weight, whole show on each one of these, but I'm saying, as we come together as a family, we look at what the conversation, male-female relationships, so could I speak to you, the average Black woman, about her hair as a Black man without being offended? Can we speak about weight?
Yes.
Can we speak about diet? And my question is, how do we do that without offending? And all the things that Black women have to say about Black men, without us airing it out to the world, can we speak behind closed doors? I think what the answer is, and Mike, it could be that the fact that when you have difficult conversations like that, you might have to bring in a third party. You might have to get counseling. If you really got an issue with the weight, really got an issue, and you find that it is causing friction with the one that you in relationship with, or even at your job, you got to bring in a third party. You can't think, I'm just going to leave you. You sabotage the relationship. A lot of good relationships get sabotaged because you realize we run up against conversations conversation that we don't know how to navigate through. We don't know how to talk to each other through this situation. Your children, don't touch my children. These are my children. You don't put your hands. You don't. We don't know how to communicate these things, and so we think you're not the one. And so then we go look for some other ethnic group or somebody else, and then we run into some more problems. But I guess what I'm saying is one of the solutions, Mike, and to everybody, we need to bring in counseling. We need to, and a lot of time, men, we don't want to get counseling. I don't need no man or nobody to come tell me how to talk to my woman if she's my woman. And so, but maybe you do. Maybe we do need to get a third party into our conversation to help mend the conversations between black men and black women so we can build what we have. That and I think, you know, I want to throw that on the table as a part of the solution. Let's search out some good counseling, and that might be, we've got Dr. Lee who's available, got Mike who can counsel young folk, and we can do this thing, and some of it can be therapeutic over some of these shows. A lot of good therapy is taking place over a lot of these shows. I say keep it going. I appreciate you, Mike. Outstanding, sir.
Definitely. I co-sign that counseling. I'll let Taylor respond to that and see what she has to think about.
I definitely think that counseling is a very beneficial aspect to relationships. I think that people should get personal therapy as well as couples therapy if they want to have fruitful relationships, because it takes a village, and that's not just to raise a black family, that's just to uphold the community as a whole. And I think when it comes to the conversations of bringing up these hard topics that we've been touching on, it all goes back on the basis of having solid communication. I think that some of these topics that we've touched on that, again, deal with personal attributes can come from a place of understanding and more love, and that can come from both black females and black males. So if you feel a way, I know in our, not just in our community, but as a society, money is very important. So you could come from the perspective of a woman feeling as though her man is broke and he needs to do better when it comes to supporting the household, and that's something that could fall back on his insecurities. But maybe the way that she's saying it, by yelling and berating at him, it's not going to click for him, and it's just going to continue to cause more turmoil in the household and in the relationship. So I think that even when it comes to things such as if you have that much of a problem with a woman's weight, I know that me personally, I grew up in a household that had very, very solid communication. Although my parents got divorced at 12, that was for different personal reasons, but I know that their communication, I never saw them argue. And when I did see them communicate and deal with their conflict, it was from a very mature standpoint of speaking out their issues, not over-talking each other, allowing each other to speak their grievances personally. So I think that that's something that we all, again, were not raised. Not everyone was privileged enough to be raised in an environment where they were taught to have fluid communication, where both sides are being appreciated and valued. But I think that conversations such as the ones that we're speaking on need to come from a place of love and understanding, more so not telling your partner to shut up or telling them that you need to be more this way than that way. But, you know, if it comes to down to weight, start going to the gym with your partner, start going on walks with them, start advocating for this to be something that we're doing as a unit. Because if you're expecting this person to change because maybe they've either fell off from a way that they were when you met them, or that they've completely, reimagined who they are at the standpoint in which you are in the relationship, then that's just a testament to the fact that maybe we're not paying attention to what they're going through mentally and what led them to this point. So bringing up things such as, again, with the hair, offer to help. I have friends right now that I know that if, again, their man might cut their weave out of their hair for them and help them detangle their hair for them to wear their natural hair on the following day or something like that. So I think if it comes from a place of not somebody just harping on you and just really kind of, like Michael touched on, just kind of ordering you to obey by this standard. You must wear your hair this way. You must be this weight for me to even show you any type of attention or anything like that, then I think that that's going to automatically cause that person to not want to have any type of change, not only just for you, but for themselves, first and foremost.
Definitely. You don't want to preach at someone. You want to progress with them. Dr. Cannon, you mentioned it, and I can't let you get away for it. I need to, you know, I'm not going to let you, and I'm being facetious here, kind of wiggle out of it. When you say exercise, you're being a part of that change too, right, Dr. Cannon? You're in the gym with her too, right? You're going to be exercising too?
Absolutely. We're looking for solutions. I'm saying I've done it wrong before, and we've done it right, but in our observation, it's a touchy conversation, and if she don't get in the gym and she gain a little extra weight and she's feeling bad about it, the more she falls into that slump, then for lack of a better word, the worse she may feel about herself, then it's going to be even more difficult to talk about the conversation. So I'm saying, absolutely, to get in there with her, to buy a pit bull and a Doberman pincher to help pull her up, everything that it takes to assist, absolutely, change my diet, and I think, you know, even getting counsel, you know, these are sensitive conversations, you know, there's women that's been abused physically in past relationships, but they don't know how to communicate it, and they don't want to come off like they've been a victim in a new relationship, so they shut down. But, you know, if the guy is saying things that's triggering, you know, past relationships, we got to communicate. And I'm saying, I think, you know, one of the answers is not leaving the relationship until you got counseling. Even if it wasn't, I mean, nothing really bad happened, traumatic, but you was in a deep, you need counseling to matriculate out. Even if it wasn't nothing traumatic, you know, or maybe it was someone passed or divorce or, you know, matriculate out, get you some good counseling, okay? Or if you got a good relationship and you just wanted, you know, there's some good books you could read, some great books, pass the books around, share ideals. And, you know, I think in life, you know, it's kind of magical, the people that come into your life that you're attracted to. It's almost divine. You can be in a room with 500 people and you're attracted to this one and spend 2 or 3 years with, okay, and that's divine. And so you don't want to exit those with bad feelings and emotions and bitterness if you don't have to. You know, if you get good counseling, read some good books together, get out, and then when you start over with, you know, a clear mind, a clear heart. You're not taking baggage into the next relationship. If we're talking about tonight, you know, men and women getting along, black men, black women, I say read some good books together, pray together, talk together. You know, two great times to communicate. After you prepare the meal for your man and you put your love into it, and then you talk for an hour after you watched him eat it up, like, man, he loved your food, your cooking, and then you sit and talk, cut the TV off and talk. After y'all had a heavenly matrimony and y'all engaged in intercourse, and then after that you should talk for an hour, 2 hours. You should pour into each other. If you miss those two times to communicate, when you baked him food and cake and you put it on the table and you let him run out with the fellas and you let him go watch TV, that's the time he should be looking into your eye and pouring his heart and his vision and telling you thank you very much for the food you prepared or the love you just given to him. Both situations you give him love, and that's when you should get communication coming back. And in that communication, that should solidify that relationship. You've baked him food, you've given him great love at night, and then in both time, he's poured his heart, you've asked the questions, and so therefore you can go on about your day, you can go on about yours, and your relationship is intact because you minister to each other properly and you've asked all the right questions, had all the right communications, and that's what I want to say, Brother Mike, and I appreciate you tonight, sir, to that.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Appreciate it, Dr. Cannon. Before I angle into a different question that is related to this, I want to, because Taylor made a very important point, brought up something that I know you've spoken about, Dr. Cannon. I want to touch more on that, which was, you know, she mentioned the fact that she saw successful communication between opposite sex in her experience growing up. And, you know, she also mentioned the fact that a lot of other people don't have that framework to work from. They don't have that experience seeing that communicational relay back and forth between two parties of the opposite sex. And that can, and most certainly does, hinder their ability to emulate that because they can't emulate something they've never seen. So I was thinking when she said that, and this is what I mean when I say you've spoken on this, because you've spoken a lot about single motherhood and its effects. If someone grows up with basically only one person, one parent, they can't really see successful communication between a male and a female, regardless of whether it's a male child or a female child. They don't have that frame of reference like Taylor if they grew up in a single parent household. So I wonder if that has a significant effect on creating these communication deficits in the relationships between, you know, black men and black women. Obviously all communities have, you know, single mother, single father households, single parent households, but with the black community, you know, we know the difference in the statistics and the rates. So I was wondering if maybe that could exacerbate the communicational deficits, the fact that they've never seen it happen if they're growing up in a household with one person, one parent.
I think when you look at the fact that women give birth to men and give birth to sons and they raise these sons, I think a lot of women have learned professionalism from corporate America. I think if corporate America has demonstrated anything, when you get in corporate America, even in Hollywood, it's laid back, but it's still professional. There's protocol that you got to rise to. And so I think a woman, even in a single home, as she's learned how to communicate with coworkers professionally, how to, you know, climb the corporate ladder, and she can then come home and emulate that with even her son without a man present. And, you know, there's some good and bad to that, you know, even with the woman going into corporate America and then coming home and she's got a husband that's not corporate America, and she's got to learn to tone that down. She can't become corporate strong at home with her man lest she, you know, destroys the self-esteem of her man. Now, she can build the self-esteem of her son with that, but with the self-esteem of her husband or her man, she has to learn how to take that corporate off and now become honey, now become sweet, become loving, because that's her position in the home, you know, to keep her sweetness intact. A lot of people say, why do men, you know, cheat, or why do men pull, you know, towards other races? I think it's in the sweetness. It's not in the beauty. It's really in the sweetness of a woman. If you got sweetness at home, then can't nobody steal your man. But if you got bitterness at home, ladies and gentlemen, the woman down the street at the cafe can steal your man. You know, if you allow bitterness, the Bible says it's better that a man go live on top of the roof than to live with a bitter and contentious woman, because you can't talk to her, you can't communicate with her. But if you can turn that thing around and get sweetness to come out of her, then that's the key. And, you know, men do that by bringing flowers and candy and a lot of things because they know they would rather have her sweetness than, you know, the other side. So I think that's the important thing in communicating. You know, we both want to be sweet, though. The woman loves a sweet man. He may be unattractive, but that brother's a sweet brother, and, you know, he woos her in with his sweetness. Well, you know, a man, you know, will be, you know, will always come home when he has a woman that's sweet and knows his heart and, you know, can tap into his heart, you know. So that's the key. I don't know if I veered off from your question, but.
Oh, no, you're fine. I do want to ask you another question as a follow-up, though, to kind of challenge something you said about, you know, if, let's say, a child lives in a single-parent household and, for instance, they live in a single mother, you know, household, and they see or they don't see another person of the opposite sex engaging in successful communication in a relationship with the person they're living at home with because they're only living with one parent. You said, you know, that this parent successfully engages in communication with people of the opposite sex when they go to work, most probably. I was thinking, well, the kid at home isn't with the parent at work, so they're probably not seeing that. But you said that they can bring it home and the kid can learn how to communicate with the opposite sex if, let's say that they actually – are the opposite sex of the person they're living with, right? Because maybe it's not a boy and a woman. Maybe it's a girl and a woman or a man and a woman. Maybe it's a single father household. So I just wanted to ask you, do you think that that can really be effective in an older person, let's say an adult, trying to make up for, let's say, okay, if a single mother household, she comes home communicating with her son, do you really think she can make up for that deficit? And likewise, do you think a single father can make up for that deficit if they don't have the other half, another person for that kid to see them successfully engaging in communication with? Because I think that even if they talk to the kid doesn't really see that as two people of the same age talking to each other successfully, like here's how that happens. I think they see it as an older person talking to a younger person, which they identify as themselves. So I don't even think they necessarily make the connection of here's what it looks like when two people around the same age successfully communicate with each other. Because even if their parents try to take the initiative to communicate with them and they live in a single parent household, I think subconsciously the kid still knows, okay, this doesn't really apply for me talking to someone of the opposite sex or even the same sex in my age range, because this is an adult talking to a younger person right now. So do you think it's still effective?
Yeah. Great question, Doc. Really. I was a single dad. Well, I had three boys in high school all at the same time. Nick Cannon's my oldest son. I got five sons. And my point was, once you understand how corporate American professionalism, how to get things done without hollering and screaming, how to delegate, then you can take your child into professional environments. And, you know, you can take them to different meetings. For instance, in Hollywood, I was able to take my sons to the Junior Actors Guild, where people are communicating. They can watch me communicate with people. There's people there their age that I can watch them communicate with. A mother, that's the best thing that she has is the community. But if she doesn't know professionalism herself, then she's going to go get trapped. She's going around and round in circles. But once she's going to corporate America will teach her, you know, corporatism, and if she instills that into her boy, you know, how to go into a board meeting. Don't say nothing, but just sit and watch how we interact in here, you know, or a conference, take him to the conference, you know, take him into meetings, take him to the city council meeting where adults are communicating, where you're standing up and communicating with those adults, where, you know, you can get them involved in communicating. In a single-parent household, you get your child ready to communicate with the world, and then you take them out into the world in different environments every weekend so that they can see how things function. Because at that point, we are their eyes. But once they learn how to function in those environments, they're going to grow quicker and faster, and they will become our eyes. That means at first we were showing them how things work, and then like my son in Hollywood now, he said, "Dad, this is how this works, blah," and he puts everything in place for me. And that's a beautiful situation where we want to get. So even as a single mom, you want to introduce your children, your young men, to all the powerful people, organizations in your community, and make sure they go to that meeting. Because at the Junior Actors Guild, now they want your son to be the vice president or the secretary. And now he's learned, you know, Robert's rules of orders or parliamentary procedures. And now he can begin to learn. You just got to introduce him to those corporate structures at a young age, and absolutely he'll catch it. And I'm sure, Mike, that's what was done for you at a young age, because you are a brilliant young man.
Most definitely, yeah. You can usually see them apply that in, you know, how they carry themselves and how they communicate with other people and the relationships they form. So that definitely is an effective strategy for the people who have the option of bringing their kids to work with them, definitely. Let me switch gears a little bit and ask another question that's going to kind of open up another discussion, but that's still similar to this. What, if any, Taylor, this is directed to you, what, if any, impact do you think systemic racism has had on the state of the relationships between black males and black females in the United States, in your opinion?
I think it plays a significant role between the relationships between a black male and a black female. In America, I think that systematically there can be some resentment. As speaking from as a black female, I think there can be some resentment from our end, because this world operates, again, like I said, from a from a supremacist standpoint, but it's also it also operates from a patriarchal standpoint, and there are benefits that black men do not receive from the patriarchy that is upholded in this country. And so I think that while they're dealing with those grievances as black men and feeling less than in this country, we also deal with the back burner of that, and we deal with taking care of the home in that same aspect. So I think that there's a sort of resentment that is built upon systemic racism and how it affects the black family and the black home, because I feel women feel as though they're not listened to, and neither do men, and they're not listened to from an internal standpoint, but as a whole, we're not listened to by society. So I think that both of those senses of silence and the addition to systemic racism, that is what causes the ultimate downfall for us as a community.
Definitely, especially with the, you know, in terms of the political status, the double minority status of, you know, females in society relative to males.
Yes.
Do you think that when you say that, are you saying that, let's say, black men, because of the system that we live in, are, let's say, projecting, I guess, the lack of a voice and influence that maybe the system intentionally set up for them not to have, and projecting that onto women? So let's say the system doesn't really listen to them, and it's designed not to, and
yes.
So then they don't listen to women.
And I think
women,
just to adhere to your point, I think that projection isn't purposeful. I want to be mindful in saying I don't think that, you know, I can't speak for black men as a whole, but I think that in the personal experiences that I've had, I don't think that it's something that's done intentionally. I think that, again,
yeah,
it's something that's systematic, and that it's
designed
in order for us to
be. Most of this is subconscious behaviors.
It's all a cognitive dissonance when it comes to what we've been designed and programmed into adhering to as black people, because we're looking at society from a whole different totem pole. They're just, if you look at the way that some even white women look at their college experience, some white women go to college in order to marry, and that's not the same sentiments that black women may have, because they're looking at it from a more career standpoint. So I think that when the society has been cultivated towards white people and it lacks any type of acknowledgement for our culture and what the grievances that we have dealt with through centuries and centuries of different turmoil when it comes to racial trauma, I think that denying that systemic racism is definitely at the backbone of the grievances between black females and black males, that would just be almost a delusion.
Definitely. And most of these behaviors we're talking about, you know, they're mostly subconscious. We definitely don't really, and there isn't really any good evidence to suggest that most people are conscious in any of these things they do when they project. But you bring up a good point about how systemic racism has made it so that, like you said, black women, as opposed to, let's say, white women, going to college more so for the purpose of self-preservation and making money to survive, versus white women going to college more so for the purpose of, you know, personal, philosophical and emotional fulfillment and maybe looking for a mate. That's a very different world. One is, you know, for survival, and one is for kind of luxury, because of the fact that systemically certain populations have been afforded more.
And I also want to add that that's not every single white woman's experience, and I understand that, but I know that just from what I saw and just
in
being
general,
admitted into college, and yeah, from a high school standpoint of just hearing conversations of why people were choosing to go to certain schools and what type of caliber of man they were looking forward to meeting when they got to that school. And I think that, unfortunately, we are accustomed to not looking at black men in that light, and that's unfortunate because it's not their fault. It's just a matter of how the system has left them to not being able to even succumb to that, to that level. And I think that that's something that we both have to take the brunt of as both black females and black males. Like, I think that both of our issues kind of counteract with each other, and we both kind of take the hit for something that we may not actually experience, but it's something that affects our experience as a whole.
Definitely. I definitely think that because of the, you know, systemic privileges and wealth that's been disproportionately placed in the hands of white people, like I said, black people, when they go to college, are not really going, most of the time, unfortunately, as they should be for any educational institution you're going to, personal fulfillment, and, you know, really for personal fulfillment. They're mostly going for self-sufficiency. They're trying to get a career to make money to make up for the socioeconomic deficit that they were probably born into. And so when they meet other people, they kind of, you know, have to only accept people that they can see themselves grinding with, so to speak, in business and making money with, because they're all about making money because they have to be given the predicament they're in. And so, and a lot of times that can cause a lot of strain and extra strife on relationships compared to maybe people coming from communities where money isn't really as big of an issue, and they're mostly going there for personal fulfillment, not to get a job and pull themselves and the people they live with in their community out of poverty. So definitely. Dr. Cannon, what are your thoughts on this?
On racism
and how it affects our relationships between black males and black females.
I definitely think there's a game that's definitely being played, and if we continue to let it be played on us, you know, I think the strongest thing that Oprah could do once she marries a black man is to surrender her billions and say, I believe in you so much, Mr. Stedman. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to take your name, and I'm going to be and all my riches at your feet. And that will speak volumes of the fact that the black woman respects the black man so much that even if corporate America gives her riches, she brings those riches home to her man, lays him at his feet with respect that he's going to do the right thing for the family, and she trusts the black man again. You know, there's a movie called Chirac that my son Nick played in, and it's controversial, but it has a lot of meaning to it, y'all. I'd recommend, you know, showing it to some young people, having conversation. It has a sexual overtone because the gist of it was the black women were fed up with the fact that they were giving the birth to these young black men, and then by the time they get 13, 14, 15, they was killing each other. So their solution was, they had a solution, y'all, in the movie Chirac. The solution was that the women came together. I'm not going to tell you what the solution was. You got to go get the movie. But the women came together all across the country with the attitude, we're going to stop this killing where these brothers are killing each other in these streets. My point is they had to come together and have a conversation, and a sensitive conversation. What do we do when we can't talk to each other? We will destroy each other. And that's what we see happening in our communities with the Bloods and the Crips and the gangs across the country. We're devouring and destroying and shooting and killing each other because we don't know how to talk to each other. Imagine if George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, if somewhere in that few minutes, they would have turned around and just had a wholesome conversation, went off to McDonald's and bought a Big Mac and a Coca-Cola and sat down and had a conversation. We in America, we got to learn to communicate, y'all. We rioted across the street country in a country where we got churches on every corner. In a country where Dr. King taught us about love and how we should love one another, gave his life for it, and then we start talking civil war. Shame on us as a people. We need to consult God is the final answer to give us answers on how to communicate with one another, how to build our families, how to build our brothers, how to look after other people's concerns more than our own concern. If I can become more sensitive to what the black woman is saying, and if I can hear her, if I can seek to understand before I seek to be understood, then I think we can get over some of these humps, get some of these monkeys off of our back, get some of these things that's weighing us down to a whole nother level, y'all, where we can begin to communicate together, prove to the world that we are beautiful, powerful, communicatable people here in America. Michael, it's been an outstanding show, a lot of great conversation. I appreciate you tonight's show. Sir, I appreciate Dr. Lee. Dr. Tatum, I know he's sitting waiting. He didn't get him in. If he's still on the line, Dr. Tatum, sir, you got anything to conclude in this conversation?
I didn't know Dr. Tatum was on the line. Yeah. I would have. I'm sorry, Dr. Tatum. I didn't know you were on the line. I would have definitely had you come back in here.
Yeah, no problem. This has been great. I'm just going to add a couple of things and keep it going. This next week for me and my wife, we've been married 43 years. And that when we got married, she was 17. I was 19.
Wow.
So
wow.
We have greatly over the 43 years as far as communication, understanding as an African-American man and African-American woman coming from two strong black families with both parents in the house all the way into our adulthood. My dad passed away at 85, mom at 86. Her dad passed away at 89, mom in her late 80s. So they live a fruitful life. And we have 9 grandkids, and we're pouring into their lives and teaching them how to articulate their vision and their purpose. And some of the reasons why we have these conversations that kind of turns into conflict because we don't understand who we are in our lineage and our genealogy. Once you understand who you are and your family, you begin to have a certain level of respect. So that's my input for tonight, and God bless.
Well, Dr. Tatum, real quickly, sir, but on those sensitive issues like, being married that long, on those sensitive issues like we talked about, what's the secret of having those conversations?
Oh, those kind of conversations. It's a prayer, you know. A lot of people don't understand. The Bible said, you know, don't be unevenly yoked. So spiritually, you know, you got to know, have Christ in the center of your life. So before you say anything to your mate, your significant other, you must seek God first so he can give you a way to approach and to say something in a delicate way that they can understand. You know, all of us have a certain way how we approach a situation. So we got to know how to talk to our mate from how they were brought up, how they understand life. Because when you come into a relationship, you come from two different dynamics. And the more you learn about their family background and they learn about yours, you understand how their parents communicated. Because that way that young woman you're about to marry, because I'm wearing my wife, she was 17. She came from a household. It was just her and her brother. I came from a household. It was like six of us. So when we sat at the table, everybody is scrambling to get the last piece of food or chicken or whatever, where she and her brother, you know, they had plenty. So I had a different perspective. So if she made a meal, I'm rushing. It's just me and her. So you got to understand little things like that, how you were brought up, how many people were in the house when you were brought up, versus you have to fight over something versus being courteous and say, oh, you know, you can have this. It's just little things that you don't pay attention to. So understanding who you are in Christ, understanding where that person come from as far as their family dynamics and how they were brought up, that's very important. A lot of people don't think about that when they get married. And then thoroughly understanding where you're going in the future, what is your purpose together when you come together, not just to buy a house, buy a car, or do financial things, but what are you going to do together for your community, for God, and how do you impact the world around you?
Amen. Right. Congratulations, sir, on your anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you. God bless. Thank you.
Okay. I'm being told by the text we have someone called in to the show. Someone's number ending in 1327 and their line is open. If your number is ending in 1327, your line is open and you have the floor. You can speak.
Hey there. Good evening, everyone. My name is Hotep, and thanks for a great show. I'm a first-time caller. If I could just focus in on the areas that I have a different view, because I agree with almost everything else, that religion from this plantation has been the tool utilized, whether it's from Arabia or from Europe or white America, to divide us. And I think that black, white, red, and yellow, these terms, even though all of us use them, they actually come from Carl Linnaeus, who was a person that believed that we, the darker original humans, were inferior. So for me and my circle, who are atheists, who know that Jesus Christ, the name itself, didn't exist around the time of early Christians, we generally don't fit into circles because our foundation is not religion. Our foundation is dark humans in Africa. And if you look at Kemet, Egypt, you would find that most of the Western Anglo-religious religions, Catholic to some degree, Jehovah's Witness, Mormons, Baptists, all have foundations in Africa, more specifically in Egypt and in what we call Abyssinia today, well, what we call actually Ethiopia, which at one point was Abyssinia. So I'm enjoying the show, but I don't have a religious foundation, nor one in Americanism. In other words, black American. I think the Pan-African perspective is a deeper one, because what happens is the rest of the world rapes Africa, but most of us in North America only think, I think, not on this show, but generally from a black African, black American, I'm sorry, perspective, and that I think is a grave injustice to our ancestors in Africa. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate the show.
Absolutely, and thank you for that addition. Let me just say, caller, most of us on here are Pan-Africanists. We definitely appreciate you know, the sentiment you express. We agree with it. We're speaking from the perspective of Black Americans just because we don't want to speak too broadly. You know, speaking from the perspective of Black Americans, saying that is already, you know, pretty a broad claim as it is, saying that we speak for Black America. So it's not that we don't connect to the global African diaspora. Believe me, we definitely do. We agree with you there on the Pan-African perspective. We just want to, you know, make sure we don't overstep our boundaries in a sense, because we are all, I'm pretty sure, on this line, Black Americans. And when you raise an excellent point about alienation, you're not a religious person. Some people on the call are religious. Some people aren't. Some people are going to be whatever they're going to be. It's very important that, one, as I've been saying throughout this discussion, we learn how to hear opposing views or opinions by other people without getting hysterical. We learn how to hear that and, you know, decide whether or not we want to integrate that information and use it for something, or if we want to discard it. But when we do discard it, you know, just discarding it, not invalidating it, but just simply, you know, acknowledging that it's not for us, but that it could absolutely be for someone else and can be just as valid as our belief system is for us as it could be for someone else. So I want to thank you for calling in and raising that issue, because that is an important issue that we should all, you know, learn how to hear opinions and perspectives from, you know, different ideological paradigms than our own, and not, you know, be hysterical or go ballistic. We should learn how to, or be more resilient to that, right? If we hear someone or something that we disagree with, or someone say something that we don't agree with, we don't always need to attack that and challenge it. We can just let someone have their own personal beliefs and opinions to themselves. So thank you for calling in and mentioning that, because it is important we don't alienate.
And related to what you're saying, can I have 30 seconds or do you need to move on?
Oh, no. You can go right ahead.
Because I think if we think from it from a circle, in the circle is all of us, what we call African, Pan-African, Black, straight, gay, Christian, atheist, right? So what the so-called white, which we could consider our lighter humans, have been able to do is at critical times come together and say, look, white Anglo, I don't care if you're Christian, atheist, American, or British, how are we going to exploit what we haven't been able to do? Is say, look, I don't care if you're atheist, Christian, Muslim, straight, gay, whatever, how can we not get abused? That has been so difficult for us to get over. So for me and the people in my circle, we go into circles looking for that, meaning we don't care what people's gender is, their religion, whatever, their anthem. We think, okay, can I work with you to do something positive for us and our people? And then you go and do whatever you do in your bedroom, in your place of worship, in your school. But it's very tough. But, you know, we can do it if we continue to be open-minded. And thanks for the time. I appreciate it. I'll continue listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent point. Definitely. And the way that we find a solution to encompass as many people as possible who share our agenda in the Black community, regardless of their ideological predisposition or their sexual orientation, is through better communication. We have to, simply put, be open and honest about what our personal agendas are and if they align with one another. And for the people who our agendas don't align with that are part of our community, we need to be able to respectfully just say, okay, well, we're going to go this way, you're going to go that way. I'm not going to invalidate your choice, but we're going to go this way. You know, best of luck to you. But the way in which we bring people together, like you mentioned, Europeans at different points in history, especially most recently post-1800s, where you had a lot of European immigrants come over here who weren't considered white, like the Irish and Italian, and were given honorary white status to form a political supermajority to help, you know, white people vote against certain policies that would take away their privilege, or vote for policies that would bolster their privilege against the Black population that was here. The way in which we unify is first and foremost by, and this is what this discussion is all about, communication, better communicating what our agenda is. So I am Pan-Africanist. I'm a non-integrationist, meaning I don't support, and really my goal is for Black people to own and control as much as humanly possible of their resources and their environment, right? I'm not interested in sharing ownership with other groups of our community's money, our schools, our hospitals, our grocery stores. My goal, the same goal that most other communities have too, even though they don't really, they're not as open about it, a little more passive aggressive. I want to, as a black person, own and control everything in the black community. And I want it controlled and owned by black people. And my mission extends globally to all black communities. That's why it's Pan-Africanist. So if someone says that after hearing me communicate that, yes, I agree with that, or saying, you know what, no, I don't agree with that. I actually don't really care if people from outside our group control our banks and our businesses. And my goal is not as a black person to try to make sure, you know, we as black people control and own as much as our environments as humanly possible. I would say, okay, that's perfectly fine. No problem. We have a disagreement there in agenda. Best of luck to you on your journey with what you're doing. But we've successfully communicated that, and I've made sure that that person is not in my circle, and I'm not in their circle, because if we went, you know, years going to the same meetings, the same black empowerment meetings, and, you know, in the same online pro-black, Facebook groups, but we didn't realize that we actually had two different agendas, this can cause a lot of conflict. Because when it's time, after we, you know, do all the stuff, we listen to all the black history, the Kemet, the Egypt, the Moors, we listen to all the history about, you know, Grainville T. Woods and Lewis Latimer, all the black inventions and all this stuff. After we do all that stuff and it's time to actually act, we're saying, all right, now let's make a move, and we both go in opposite directions. That's a problem. We can avert that if we communicate to each other first and foremost, hey, I'm for this agenda. Person says, well, actually I'm for that agenda. And they say, okay, well, best of luck to you. We don't really need to be a part of the same group because we're not striving for the same things. Not because, you know, I don't support your right to choose the agenda you want to choose, but just because we foresee that you can't go in two different directions at the same time. And we got to that understanding that we are going in two different paths, two different directions by communicating, by saying, hey, this is what I am. This is what I support. This is what I don't support. You know, if you agree with that, great. If you don't agree with that, perfectly fine. And, you know, best of luck to you on your journey. So I'm glad the caller called in to mention that about, you know, bringing people together, because unity and division are inherently neutral. They're not positive or negative things. They can be positive or negative depending on how it's applied. People can unify for something that's negative. People can unify for something that's deemed subjectively as positive, right? People can unify in a group called a mob and lynch a person, or people can unify in a group called, you know, a protest and push back against tyranny. So, and like I said, division as well as unity, not objectively good or bad. People can be divided. Like, let's say you're divided, your community with a community of Nazis, right? That's a good division. You don't need unity there. If you're divided, those two communities, that's good. But if you're divided with, let's say, other people who are not Nazis, maybe people who are other decent people, then that could be bad. So it's all neutral. And in order to make sure that we're unifying with the right people who share our same agenda, we have to be able to communicate it. So communication is pivotal. Is there anyone else in the queue? Did anyone else press one on their phone and wants to say something in our listening audience? If not, then we are coming to the close of the show. We still have a couple minutes. I want to allow Dr. Cannon to give any of his last remarks he wants to give, any of his final concluding remarks about tonight's show, and any final comments he has. Dr. Cannon. You there, Dr. Cannon? Can you hear me okay? Okay. Is Dr. Cannon's line still open? If you can hear me, Dr. Cannon, make sure your phone isn't muted. Press one on your phone if you can hear me. Otherwise, I'll take it over to Taylor for some final thoughts and concluding remarks. about tonight's discussion.
I just want to thank everyone for listening and for this, you know, very open-minded discussion that we had. I know that we went on to great detail with a lot of different topics, but I do think that a lot of different sides were both presented and respected in the conversation that we had. And I want to thank you, Michael, for the dialogue that we had as well, and anyone that tuned in. And I just look forward to more conversations in the future. And thank you all for the one that we had tonight.
Well, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it. I don't know if Dr. Cannon is on. Dr. Tatum, I know you kind of gave some final thoughts a little bit earlier, but if you could, maybe a little more abbreviated, you know, concluding remark or some comments that you want to throw in at the end or some final words. I don't know if Dr. Tatum is still on the line. Are you still in line, Dr. Tatum? Can you hear me? Okay. Do we have Dr. Cannon now? Dr. Cannon, are you on the line? All righty. Dr. Cannon isn't on the line, and Dr. Tatum isn't on the line. Then I'll just close up the show by saying, first and foremost, I want to thank all the guests who did come onto the panel, as well as the members of our listening audience who contributed to the discussion, for helping us facilitate this very substantive and needed conversation. Allows us to articulate, you know, our opinions and express ourselves in an intelligent way to help mend some of the divisions in the community, as well as to better educate each other, sharing the knowledge and the experience we all have to give. I want to give a thanks to Dr. Mary Lee. I don't know if she's here listening, but obviously without her, the show isn't possible. So a big thanks to her for allowing us to have this platform to have these discussions. And also want to thank the techs for managing everything behind the scenes. I know they're kind of the unsung heroes. A lot of people don't really know a lot of the work they do. Appreciate the work they do. Just want to say that. And if anyone listening wants to continue to support the show, just continue listening. We have shows every single Wednesday, 9 o'clock p.m. Depending on what time zone you're in, it may differ a little bit, but hopefully we can continue to do these kind of discussions and express ourselves in an intelligent way across these platforms to help educate and mend some divisions in the community and progress forward into the future. So you've been listening to Dr. Mary Lee Live. This is Michael, co-host of the show. And to everyone listening, thank you for listening, and good night.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Yes. We came from the bottom. Ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind, and it's no promise that we gon' ever actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slang. Now we locked up a game. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states. Working your forms, black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars, but you'll never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? You never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up.
Might work, still a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the rodent's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, raising dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland Security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Truth still riding, still obliging.
Still no Bill Laden.
so dead, waiting for the president's announcement.